did you think we were going to do? Perform cunnilingus on top of the wedding cake?
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week, we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This is episode one of season two, and it's called Home is Where the Ass Is.
It first aired in the U.S. on January 6th, 2002, and globally on January 22nd, 2002.
It was directed by our old favorite, Alex Chappell. He directed the cliffhanger of season one, as well as seven other episodes. We talked a lot about him in the last episode, so check that one out if you want to learn more about director Alex Chappell.
Home is where the ass is. I love saying it.
Let's see how many times we can say that in this episode.
Right, we're up to two, right?
Two.
Home is where the ass is.
Three.
Was written by showrunners Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman.
These two take primary story writing credits on every episode for the rest of the series. Season two seems to mark the start of a proper episodic TV show, writer's room style. I think last season the show was kind of all over the place in terms of themes and arcs and what was going on, and that seemed largely due to having so many different writers. Season two is really a moment in Queer as Folk where it starts to have really long story arcs and lasting impact from one episode to the next. There's not a whole lot of throwaway stuff that goes on.
I think that's also based on the fact that now they have established these characters and they are now able to do these long form arcs.
And they got rid of one of our favorite characters that will, well, your favorite character, Matt, not me.
Yes, that'll
we'll
be
talk about
coming
him
up later.
In a bit.
The Showtime synopsis. Suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder after his bashing, Justin can't remember the fateful night, and Brian can't forget it. Lindsay pops the question to Melanie at her sister's wedding. Michael returns to Pittsburgh just as Chris Hobbs is sentenced.
That's a very thorough synopsis of the episode. I have the IMDb synopsis here. Brian helps Justin recover from his bashing at the hands of Chris Hobbs. Lindsay suggests marriage to Mel. Michael returns home without David.
That IMDb synopsis is a lot more ominous than the Showtime.
So. Yeah, I guess the IMDb one had a spoiler in it, which is Michael returns home without David. And the Showtime synopsis didn't mention Dr. David at all.
No, it just says Michael returns home. Makes sense since it's the beginning of a new season.
This episode appears to start about 1 month after season one ended. That was the episode where Justin gets bashed in the head by Chris Hobbs. The scene wraps up with Michael coming off of the plane on his way to meet Dr. David in Portland, Oregon. The show finishes with that kind of overhead ER Chicago Hope shot that we see so often of a person in an ambulance being removed from ambulance. And we last see the gang, Michael and Brian in the hallway of the hospital. And that season ended. Quite the cliffhanger.
Absolutely.
So in real time, this was about, I think, 6 months later that it started to air.
This is something that, you know, I hope we get into during our discussion today, is this timeline, because if it is, in fact, just a month after this incident, I have a lot of more questions about how just a month leads to, say, Justin's recovery, which we'll get into, as well as Michael's return.
This episode opened up at Babylon, which harks back to the very first episode of the series, which also started at Babylon. I thought the similarities between the two were interesting because season one opened up at Babylon with Michael narrating it and talking about kind of the vapid gay bar scene. This one was almost the same thing, but this time it was Emmett and Ted doing the talking. And then they see a really hunky guy.
Him. Oh! Over there. Red and blue shirt, black hair, big button eyes, cute little turned up nose.
Oh, he's adorable.
He's hot.
He's a...
Michael?
Michael!
Oh, my God!
Oh my God, it's Michael. Nobody recognized him. How's that possible? It's like, he's cute. Look at the jaw. Look at the little chin and the button nose. Michael!
I think Ted clocks his big ass, too. I could have sworn
You think so?
I could have sworn I heard that, which would make sense for Ted.
Ted. He had all these lines about Blake. I think they're about Blake. He was almost in like mourning, I think.
Yes,
he said.
He said he was, it, you know, it's still too soon for him. And it seems Emmett is trying to just encourage him, you know, try it. See who do you like in Babylon. And of course, and I find it funny that he finds who turns out to be Michael so attractive.
Was it Ted that first saw him, or was it Emmett? That'd be a great little nugget if it was Ted.
It was Ted.
Was it?
I'm almost positive, because Ted, you know, as soon as Emmett asks Ted, who are you looking at tonight? And he immediately starts describing this guy that turns out to be Michael. And I'm like, Ted. Well, and it's so funny, because when they finally discover that it is Michael, it's not like they don't even show us the turnaround to reveal his face. By the time they go like, it's Michael, we look and Michael's like looking right at him. I would have loved to have seen a shot of this guy from behind, so like we can start to establish who it is they're talking about. And they're talking about all these features, and then we get their reveal.
Yeah.
And I think that would have made more sense why, they didn't recognize him when he's looking right at him.
It was dark. There was confetti in the air and there was loud music.
Laser lights.
Right.
Sure.
Did you think it was weird that Michael's first stop after he got back is to go straight to Babylon?
I think that's him knowing his friends. I mean, I'm sure.
Well, what did he take?
I'm sure it's Friday night. He's like, I know exactly where they are. Or maybe he thought, first place I'm going to look is Babylon.
It almost seemed like he checked his luggage at the Babylon coat check. Like he had gone straight from the airport to Babylon.
Yes, because when he shows up to Emmett's apartment later on, he's carrying around a duffel bag.
Yeah.
I'm like, no.
A little thin,
no, honey, no.
On the story there.
But, you know, again, it is only 2001, 2002, and I'm sure calling an Uber was not as much of the plan back then.
The story really takes off when Brian starts to come into a discussion.
Oh, there's no point looking for him, sweetie.
He's not here.
No, of course not. Not after what happened. He's in the back room.
And of course, we head back into that wonderful back room.
Todd was there.
And even Todd was like, oh, hey, Michael, it's good to see you again. As he's getting pounded from behind.
Well, hey, Todd, how's it going?
Hey, fine.
I also have to ask, so it looks like in the month or so that Michael has been gone, this back room now installed glory holes.
Oh yeah, there's that hot guy that was just like stuffing the glory hole.
But the thing is, the way that glory hole was set up, I mean,
it was more like it was just a partition. Piece of wood.
It was a glorious piece of wood that had a hole in it.
And it was like one piece of plywood or something.
I was like, is that just to set up like you're in the scene of a glory hole or what? Because it sort of defeats the purpose of the whole truly anonymous nature. I mean, the guy could have leaned over and like, oh, hey, that's the guy doing me right now.
I have never actually seen a proper glory hole. Can you tell me more about this, Matt?
When we are off mic, absolutely, Patrick.
Why not on mic? We carry the explicit rating on this podcast for a reason.
I'm just saying, in certain videos I have seen that usually these are two separate rooms. And so to have it just be a piece of plywood.
Well, we are drinking wine out of a box as we record. So let's see how much you can drink of that box and what you'll talk about at the end. So it seems at first glance that everything's business as usual for Brian. He's exactly where we'd expect him to be, in the back room, getting blown by two people.
Two.
At the same, yeah, you notice that too.
Oh, yes. He almost looked like a king on his throne with his servants at his beck and call.
As the viewer, it just seemed to me like, okay, everything's normal, typical Friday night, Saturday night, whatever it is at Babylon. But then Ted says something.
I wouldn't take it personally, sweetie.
He's cut himself off from everyone.
To everyone, that is, except for every slut in Pittsburgh with a smooth ass or a 9-inch cock.
So in other words, despite what happened, it's business as usual for Mr. Kinney.
But hey, when your boy toy gets broken, you get another toy, right?
We get a whiff that something's not quite on. After Babylon, we see that Brian's at the hospital. And again, we're seeing this for the first time. So we're starting to piece things together. And right away we can think, oh, he's at the hospital. Guess who's at the hospital? So We still don't know why he's there or what's going on, but the nurse knows who he is. And she lets us know that Brian's been there every night. And this is about a month later. So that's some duty there that Brian's performing.
It really is. It sets up that, it sets up the expectation by showing Brian doing his usual thing at Babylon, that maybe he's moved on or he doesn't care as much about Justin and the current state that he is in. However, to then say that he is now at the hospital and then have this nurse establish that he is there so often, mm-hmm. this we are now seeing that there is now has been a profound effect on Brian, having been witness to and in some ways experienced the attack himself, that we start to see where this relationship could be going for him and Justin.
At this point in the story, I just didn't quite get why Brian didn't want Justin to know that he was there. Because even if Brian thought that it was his fault, if he was just full of guilt over being the catalyst for Justin getting bashed, it just seems so cruel that Brian would act that way. Because when somebody's in Justin's state, you need to suck it up and you need to be there for them, because you don't have it nearly as bad as they do. Even though Brian could have the same PTSD that we see Justin develop, I would think that Brian, of all people, would have been the one to take care of that himself, through counseling or whatever he needed to do to get on the good side of that problem and then be there for Justin. At this point, I was not tracking with this story very much at all.
I find that interesting, because I think what we see with how it profoundly affected Brian says a lot about how powerful it was for him to see something like that, to know that he was so close. And I think we get it later on in the episode, what you're having issue with when Justin is out looking for Brian and they come together in Brian's apartment and they actually talk back about the attack. I think that helps unlock what I think you're having trouble with.
Yeah, maybe it was just a little lightweight at that point, because I didn't get the sense that Brian was like overwrought at that point. I just got the sense that he's just being a dick, like typical egotistical Brian, like, I'm going to be there, but I'm only going to be there halfway, and I'm not going to let anybody know that I actually care about him. So that's why I tripped up over that a little bit.
I do see, like, why is it so bad that he let people, that he does, why shouldn't he let people know that he's there every night? That he obviously cares for Justin, because he was there. He's probably the reason that Justin is alive, that help got there as soon as he could. Because I'm sure that had Brian not been there, there was no one to then stop Chris Hobbs from killing him.
I thought Justin's recovery process was pretty believable. I liked the writing there, because it seemed somewhat accurate. In the past, we've had writing from other writers that it just seemed a little implausible, but Cohen and Lippman, I think, did a good job of showing us what can happen after a traumatic brain injury, both physical and psychological, and the psychological carried through from Justin to Brian. So I like that they put some thought into that script.
Yeah, showing Justin doing like the therapy with the tennis ball, mm-hmm. while Jennifer Taylor, again, shout out to, I'm so happy she's in this episode.
Yeah, it's funny. We'll talk about her in a minute, but I don't think this was Jennifer Taylor's best moments, but I thought Sherry Miller did a killer job acting it.
Yes, I think I know exactly what you're talking about. But to have that discussion and knowing that Justin is pushing himself so hard to get out and to show that he's a survivor that way, it was kind of a powerful thing.
I like the writing around Michael and Brian too, because we see that Michael is cracking this shield that Brian's got up around him, and apparently he's been carrying this shield for an entire month in front of everybody else, all the other friends. Michael, already just 15 minutes into season two, is almost like a totally different character. He's confident. He's not at all the buffoon that we saw in season one. He's kind of got his act together.
It's only the first episode of season two. So.
Yeah, and 15 minutes in, but already he kind of came across being able to hold his own. And I liked that, because I thought that the way he was written in season one was a little bit too deliberately bad.
He was sort of a doormat in season one. And here, I mean, I don't know if it's because of whatever's gone on in the past month with him, with Dr. David, But he was able to come in and say, here's my problem I have with you, Brian, when he comes to his apartment. And he is starting to like say, I need to tear down whatever it is that you are putting on because you're a mess right now. What the hell is going on?
I thought I'd go see Justin. How's he doing?
How should I know?
Well, you would if you went to see him. How about you come with me?
What for?
It might make him happy.
I just told you, making other people happy can be hazardous to your health.
So can making yourself miserable.
Look, save the worried wife routine for the doc.
Yeah, and the reverse starts to happen too, where Brian seems to be getting a whiff of not everything is right with Michael. When they're in that scene in Brian's loft, there was some great writing there because it's just some breadcrumbs were being given about why Michael is in Pittsburgh. It wasn't fed to us. They didn't make a meal out of it. We just start to get hints on it. And I think that makes better scripts and better writing versus a lot of the time in season one where they just hit us over the head with something. The big reveal in this scene was Michael catching a glimpse of the bloody scarf that when Brian takes his shirt off.
It was a little disturbing. It was disturbing. I didn't really have words when I saw that reveal. I was like, has he been wearing that ever since? Because I think we last left Brian in the hospital with that scarf.
Yeah, Justin was wearing the scarf. He took it from Brian in the Jeep, and then he was walking away, and he was kind of doing a small dance with the scarf, and that's when he got clobbered. And so Brian apparently picked it up at some point in the Chicago Hope or ER hospital.
I mean, I'm almost positive he had it in the hospital. He was holding on to it.
Yeah, he did. He had it in the hallway.
The fact that he was wearing it, it's an interesting symbol of a constant awareness of the attack.
That's also one of those real life PTSD things where you have an object that you're able to cling to, and that object serves the purpose of either grounding you or continually putting you back into that state. It varies.
And considering his behavior, it very much is obviously putting the weight of the attack on Brian.
Yeah.
You know, so to constantly wear, to me, it's like he's putting on an extra 100 pounds on his shoulders.
Yeah, trying to kind of relive it every time. It's it's a little bit like a hair shirt from the Tudor era. You know, one of those garments that a priest doing penance would wear that's designed to constantly irritate and constantly remind them and constantly keep them in that moment. Oof. This is a nice bit of writing and directing there. I thought it was a little improbable that Michael would try to like catch a glimpse of Brian taking his clothes off to take a shower, but there was...
I mean, he is also in a loft, so it's we know that Brian is not shy. So I don't necessarily think that he was taking a peek. I mean, the door was wide open.
Well, Michael did just see him getting blown by two guys in the back room of Babylon. So. Yeah,
so he's pretty used to whatever. But it's that reveal of him seeing him take off his shirt to see that the scarf was underneath. I mean, I think that messes with anybody's head.
We'll be right back. In the meantime, click subscribe so that you don't miss an episode of Still Queer as Folk. There was something in the next scene that I thought was a little interesting. When we're outside the Taylor home, Debbie and Vic show up to see Justin, and there was just this gigantic media scrum as Debbie and Vic are running into the house and asking questions and things like that.
I have to ask you, what is a scrum?
It's a rugby term where...
Oh.
Like... All the and it's also a development term if you work in software development, where everybody gets together all in one place all at once and they just kind of barge on top of each other. So scrum, yeah.
Is that where scrimmage comes from?
That's scrimmage, not scrummage.
Well, it's just it sounds like it's the base. Nonetheless.
So I thought that was a little weird because these days it doesn't seem like a gay bashing attracts that much attention to where the press camps out in front of somebody's house just waiting for a story.
Well, I mean, this is not too soon after Matthew Shepard, so this is where it would definitely make sense.
Yeah, that's why I called it out, because these days it doesn't get that much of that much attention. Back then, it would have been major news in 2002.
Right. And the key is that, and I believe Jennifer mentions it, is that word has gotten out that Justin is going to be released. that's coinciding with Chris Hobbs's sentencing. So those two facts converging within the media make sense why then they're trying to bombard Jennifer with a bunch of information, or, you know, I'm sure that they probably were going to camp out and see if he was going to get out of one of the cars. Justin was going to get out of one of the cars so they could go after him too.
Did you notice that Vic looks 1,000% healthier in this scene?
It's like they figured out his drug cocktail and he's just like, what?
Like, yeah,
it's almost like he had lost weight, but in like a healthy way.
He was, and like, he was like tanned and ripped, and
he's like, I went to Cancun for a week, you know?
Yeah.
It was very interesting to see such a drastic change in Vic.
I did like that Conan Lippman kind of reset the character a little bit. In season one, he just seemed to be dragging himself around from scene to scene, and I just thought it was a little much. But back in 2001, HIV positive people had a very different life than they do now. Maybe seeing him in season two makes it a little bit more contemporaneous.
Sure. I mean, yeah, it was like he had a death shroud. Like, yeah, there was a certain level of a depressive state that he was in the first season. And here it's just like, yeah, I'm just helping her with the marinara sauce. So it's like,
yeah. Well, speaking of that, that's something else that I tripped up over in this scene. Justin comes down, Sunshine. Debbie sees him and wants to give him a big hug. Justin mistakes the marinara sauce for blood and has a bit of a panic attack. And the part that I tripped up on, though, is that less than an hour later, he has snuck out of the house with Daphne.
Is it really an hour? Because it was like nighttime when they were out. So
well, they were bringing, I guess, dinner over. So maybe it was late afternoon, early evening. Sure. Possibly tea time.
It was a late lunch.
I just thought it was unusual that Justin had like that kind of a reaction. But then he was like all set to leave the house. But it played into the scene a little bit.
It did carry that, like, I just need to get out of this house. So, like, I think...
Wasn't it good to see Daphne back, though?
Oh, yeah. We hadn't seen her. She's like, I'm going to pick you up. I'm going to help you sneak out of the house. It's like, ugh, old
friends.
She
didn't have anything meaningful in many episodes. She was present in the last episode at the prom.
She's literally a chauffeur.
Yeah.
Because all she does is she picks him up. Justin is like, I need to get out of this house, because I'm sure that he's probably feeling smothered, even though I think Jennifer is doing everything a mother should.
I love the way that Justin described it. Sunshine and all those other words. I thought it was really strange, though, that Daphne just abandons him on Liberty Avenue.
I know. I would have thought that she would have been like, well,
she's going to at least follow him secretly or something. She just like opens the door. He gets out and she like hits the gas. Like,
she's like, bye. I got homework. And just, yeah. I'm going to hop out of Liberty Avenue and leave you to the. I think what's so interesting about Justin's reappearance on Liberty Avenue is that it's a very interesting reflection on how we first met Justin.
Oh, yeah.
In the first season, where he's like bright eyed and like he feels like it's like the good dangerous, like I don't know what's gonna happen tonight. And then it was like an overwhelming in a good way in the first season, in the first episode. Here, because of the attack, it's now like sensory overload.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost too much for him to handle. And, you know, someone tries to see how he's doing, some stranger comes up to him and he freaks out and he's like, I can't. And he runs off.
It was pretty terrifying. If you can empathize with the character at all, seeing him in this state was just like a lot to take in. And then you realize, okay, he's there for a reason. He's looking for Brian. And that's where it starts to get pretty interesting. So I can relate to Justin like trying to find Brian. It hits a peak when he walks into Woody's, comes face to face with Brian. We get the normal swishy music. But then Michael's the one that calls out Brian for not engaging with him. It's always interesting to me when Michael and Justin like have a moment, when Michael is empathizing with Justin, because there was just so much animosity in the first season.
In the beginning, absolutely.
Yeah. I wasn't entirely tracking with this whole storyline, though. Again, there's Brian. He comes face to face with him. It's like, Brian, get your shit together. It's like,
right,
this poor kid.
Well, and yeah, and Michael is watching this because I'm pretty sure he even points out he's seen Brian doing self-destruction at a level he's never seen before. You know, even when Justin comes into the bar and a crowd, obviously gay men would recognize who Justin is, because clearly with media attention, they all swarm and Michael is there to save him. It's fascinating to see that level of self-destruction in Brian and not really dealing with the attack.
Yeah, it almost seemed like the story became more about Brian than about poor Justin, who got whacked in the head with a baseball bat and had his skull drained of blood. It just seemed a little ill-timed that Brian has to make everything about him. He's not making it. It was just written that way.
But, I mean, that also makes sense for Brian.
Yeah. I guess in season one, we saw enough of him caring about Justin that I expected more from Brian Kinney. And a lot of people would say, this is Brian. He's this, that, and the other thing.
I know, but he's your hero, Patrick, but
he's not my hero. I just try to see a different side to him than a lot of people do. I don't look for the popular view that Brian's this, that, and the other thing, and he acts this way because of this. I just don't buy that. I try to find something a little more meaningful in the character, and it just didn't seem like it was in character for him to be so uncaring about Justin and to have him like so wrapped up into his own PTSD.
Would you say that he's uncaring given that he's been in the hospital literally every night, like looking over Justin?
Well, first of all, that's a sign that you've got problems. So if that nurse in that hospital had any sense,
should we be calling security? Is that what you're saying?
Not security, but like suggesting, hey, maybe you should talk to somebody about this because you're having problems with this and there's people that can help. But instead, it just became more about me with Brian. I didn't like that.
This is literally what I've been saying since season one, but okay. But no, like it, to me, it makes sense for the Brian character based on how the writing has taken him that he will handle his situation in the best way he knows how, which is likely to suppress it with sex, drugs, alcohol,
or
cutting people out of their lives. I mean, look at how he decided to cut himself out of Michael's life to help Michael and Dr. David Cameron's relationship.
I had problems with that.
He went totally apeshit and went far above and beyond what was necessary to do that. So for him to not want to deal with what he's experiencing after the attack, you might react in a different way. I might react in a different way, but for how Brian Kinney has been set up as a character, it made sense to me that they would amp up his behaviors that a lot of us see as dangerous or destructive or selfish.
Yeah, you almost have to buy into that Brian Kinney archetype that the jumble of writers last season had set up for us. Going forward in seasons 2, 3, 4, and 5, I think that the character gets a little more coherent. And maybe that's what I'm tripping up on here is just some of the incoherency that we had of the character in the first season. From Woody's, Brian and Justin apparently teleport back to Brian's loft. This was such an awkward scene between Brian and Justin where Brian is clearly like terrified of hearing from Justin and Justin doesn't remember anything. But once we're in the safety of Brian's loft, we start to see the old Justin, the season one Justin.
Yeah, he almost seems like he's trying to continue to impress Brian.
Yeah.
Yep. Like when he describes his injury, he's like, this is how close to death I was.
Yeah,
and
totally.
I'm like, is that really something to brag about?
It was one of those awkward moments where you are in a weird situation and you're making small talk that you're having to put a little more thought into because the person that you're making that small talk to means so much more to you. It's almost like big talk in a small talk situation. The thing that I didn't quite understand here is, did anyone visit Justin in the hospital? I mean, Debbie, Daphne, Vic, Michael, Emmett, well, Michael was gone. Ted, nobody went to the hospital. That whole part is left out. Whereas when Ted took GHB with the twink, everybody went and saw him, even Debbie. So why was that left out when the fan favorite character has been in the hospital for a month?
I mean, this comes down to the, and I have notes about this when it gets to it later when we talk about Michael's situation, but there is a lot of telling and not showing with this season two opener.
Yeah.
And so we are going to be told, maybe it was a schedule, budgetary, the way they decided to carry the storyline kind of thing, but we had to treat a lot of dialogue as, well, this is what happened while we were away, and we're just going to describe it to you rather than spend the money to film it.
I did like in this scene how Brian is able to tell Justin what happened, and it was frightening. It had a lot of flashbacks in it, and there were quite a few cuts in there that I don't think we saw in the cliffhanger of season one. You know, like that close-up shot of literally Justin getting whacked in the head, and it was pretty terrifying.
Right. I mean, have you ever seen the movie Jackie, the recent one with Natalie Portman? It's on HBO Go. I highly recommend it. But I was watching it literally just yesterday. They do something very similar where she, you know, she plays Jackie Onassis, you know, and she's with her priest and literally recounts what it was like being in the car with Kennedy as he gets shot. And the same thing kind of happens where she's describing it, and then it cuts to that moment, and like, and they are not shy about showing it. Like, you hear the gunshot, you see what happened to Kennedy's head, you see her trying to literally like pick up his brains and hold it. Like, and it was so interesting to then watch this episode and see something, a very similar device happen, where we see a character saying, this is what I experienced, and then we cut to it and see it in its full gory detail. It allows to really land that effect that the event has on that character.
It really landed here, and the scene seemed like Brian needed to admit to Justin that he couldn't stop it.
I saw him. He was coming after you with a bat. But he was moving too fast and you were too far away. And I ran, but there was no time to stop it. And then he swung. It was too late. There was nothing I could do.
It seemed like that was one of the key things with Brian's psyche here, is that he felt like he should have been able to stop that attack. He couldn't. And he had to tell Justin. He also had to tacitly admit that he was ultimately the cause of this. He was the one, the 30-year-old that showed up at the high school prom and did the suggestive dance with Justin. He precipitated the attack on him, and he had some responsibility for it that he had to own up to there.
And I think that it only made sense for him to quote unquote own up to it only to Justin. I don't think that's something that he could really...
No. He wouldn't tell anybody else.
No, exactly. And I don't think that's... Because they would all... I am sure everyone would say, no, it's not your fault. You can't do that. Blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, I think for him to maybe feel some sort of... To feel absolved of what happened, he has to confess that to Justin.
I did like that Justin suddenly became the strong one in that relationship. He repeatedly told Brian it wasn't his fault. And that almost seemed like the absolution that Brian needed to hear. And he kind of snapped out of it at that point. It was a very subtle moment in the script. But from that moment on, everything was different with Brian. He got out of this like weird, hazy funk that we found him in when the episode started. Still, I don't like how this became a Brian thing. I wanted more Justin here.
I think Justin sort of will have his own journey, because the first thing he has to do is he has to recover.
Learn to jack off with his other hand, apparently.
You have to be ambidextrous. Because, yes, if you have not watched the episode, we understand that he's really working only his right hand to gain strength and mobility again.
Well, that was something a little bit light in the writing, too, where Justin says,
they say I may never draw again.
Many artists in history have lost the use of their dominant hand and have picked up the brush or the pen or whatever with their other hand. I think the only exception is like a camera, which almost every camera is right-handed.
Oh my God, you're right.
Yeah. I'm the photographer.
Well, of course you would know.
And I'm right-handed too.
Aha.
there was a cute little moment where Brian drops off Justin. Justin thanks Brian for saving him tonight.
Thanks. For what? The ride. Saving me. I didn't save you. I meant tonight.
Those lines had a little more weight to them than just that. There was a cute look of Jennifer Taylor, who hears the Jeep apparently and bursts open the front door and is looking out. And she does this after she shoos Justin into the house, 18-year-old Justin, like, get back in your room. She does this quick little double take back to Brian. It was a really, really subtle move. And hats off to Sherry Miller for that one.
I like that. I also just love that Justin says, I left a note.
Yeah. I mean, he is 18, so...
I mean, he is 18. I mean, he is still recovering from a traumatic brain injury, right, so right. I understand the fear, because, you know, he's still technically in recovery, even though he's home. I also just felt like there's, again, a lot of, like, mirroring things we saw in the first season, especially in the early episodes that I'm really liking, and we see things that are a little more tender than they were previously. Yeah.
The next scene in the courtroom had these weird comedy moments woven into it. This is the scene with Judge Regular Roy.
Court will recess for 10 minutes.
Where the fuck's he going?
It's a hell of a time to leave. What great suspense.
It's how he got his name, Regular Roy. Every day at 12:15 on the dot, he goes to the bathroom across the hall, sits in the stall under the window, takes a dump, and has a smoke.
Debbie had a good interjection in that scene where she says,
I'll tell you how. Chris Hobbs is a homophobic animal who should be put away.
And saying it very loudly.
Yeah.
Which I'm
loud enough
sure,
for Roy to hear it.
Yeah. And which it makes me wonder, do you think because he heard her say this so loudly that affected how he was going to sentence Chris Hobbs?
Well, I don't think Debbie caused it, if that's what you mean.
No, I don't think she caused it, but do you think that may have assisted in his certain words of choice in describing how he was going to sentence Chris Hobbs?
Yeah, maybe. There was, this was really an example of gay panic. And that is a defense that in 2018 is still legal in all but two states. Those states are California. And as of July 1st, 2018, Illinois, there's only two states in the U.S. where gay panic cannot be used as a defense for attacking somebody. That's a pretty scary thing. And interestingly enough, in Illinois, there was almost zero Republican objections to that bill when it went through. That's pretty astonishing when you think about it, especially considering the current political climate.
That's all I got is,
After he gets the sentencing and everybody's out on the sidewalk, I loved how all these men had to shield Chris Hobbs from Debbie when she started to stampede towards him. It's like running of the bulls.
Right. If we can go back for a second. So basically what happens is, one, we find out that, you know, Regular Roy is Regular Roy because exactly at 12:15 he goes and takes a shit and a smoke. Even when he's in the middle of fucking sentencing for this media spectacle case that everyone is waiting to hear how Chris Hobbs is gonna fucking get it.
It's a weird bit of lightheartedness thrown into like a really serious scene.
And it's very clear that the judge is homophobic and is saying that had it not been for Justin flaunting his lifestyle in front of a fine, upstanding man like Chris Hobbs, it was astounding to me watching it in 2018, hearing a judge speak like that, because I'm sure that today, with how social media is, as soon as those court transcripts came out, there would be a massive, massive fallout from it. But
I don't think there'd be any fallout per se, but I think there would be people like Debbie who are doing what she was talking about, where we're going to march, we're going to call all of our troops together to rise up.
This speaks to Sharon Gless's performance in this particular moment, because it's so interesting to watch the gay men and women in this scene acknowledge that they sort of knew that this is how it was going to go.
I think back in 2002, there really was an expectation that the gay character is never going to win, that there will always be some sort of penalty imposed just for being gay.
And so to watch Debbie, who we have known to be a very fierce queer advocate, be the one who wants to lead this charge against Hobbs. And it took a lot of people to hold her back as she literally charged towards him. I very involuntarily was screaming. I was like, Debbie, get him. Like, I was like, Debbie is such a dead mother to the gay men and women in this show that I like to think of her as my own little dead mother who would literally do anything for me.
That led to a little bit of a cliche thing that I hate to see. Debbie's all riled up and Michael says, come on, let's go home and get some rest. I just hate it. This is the second time that Michael has said that.
It really, it treats Debbie as an old woman. And I think she's, while a woman of her years, she is not frail.
Well, yeah.
She's
and
not
well,
fragile.
As is, get some rest is going to make anything better.
It's like, get her, it's like, get her a glass of water. What is water going to do?
Yeah, right.
Like, come on.
It reminds me of in The Godfather one at the very end where Kay is finding out that Michael really did kill everybody. And his sister Connie's in there, and Connie goes hysterical.
And, oh, and she's and like hitting him with the open wrist and stuff.
Yeah, and Michael says, get her a doctor.
It's just... it's the 40s. She's a hysterical woman. What are you going to do? I do
get
love
her a doctor.
That moment. I love Talia Shire in that. She's so good.
Finally, in this episode, Michael admits to Brian that he broke up with Dr. David. And I loved how Brian had already figured it out.
Of course he did. Of course he would have just figured it out.
I thought this was some really clever writing from Cohen and Lippman, though. Because without giving Brian any particular superpower, they just leveraged that notion that Brian knows Michael better than Michael knows himself. He knew that Michael would never be happy being the doctor's wife. And he called that out way back in season one when Dr. David gave him the gold Miata. So I like that they were very clever about the way they wove that into the story where Brian just says,
I know.
What did Ted Nammett tell you?
No, I managed to figure it out all by my little self. I mean, I knew it wouldn't work out.
Well, congratulations. Right as usual.
This isn't about me, asshole. It's about you. I mean, did you really think you'd be happy in Wisconsin? Playing the doctor's wife?
Oregon. Portland's in Oregon.
Whatever the fuck.
There's this great little moment where Michael turns around and leaves, and Michael can't see Brian, and he says, you'll be able to get your E wholesale. And then Brian does this little nyan-nyan-nyan-nyan look on his face. I thought it was really clever. It was nice that the line wasn't played directly to the character, that he was just kind of like, yeah, with it. It's good directing there, too.
I have trouble saying that the writing was clever, that Brian knew it wasn't going to work out.
Well, no, I like the cleverness of how it was woven in to the story. It's, of course, he's going to know. It's like, he's Brian Kinney. He knows all. I just like the way that they didn't beat us over the head, that Cohen and Lippman just worked it into the story gently.
I'm kind of on that. I don't know.
Why?
Like, is it really the time to gloat in front of Michael?
Well, that's the part that I liked was clever, is that he wasn't gloating. He was just like, I know.
No, because he's like, you think you wouldn't have been happy being up there in Wisconsin? Or something? It's like, come on, you know he went to Portland. You know?
Or as Brian said, the fuck ever.
Exactly. To me, that was him gloating. Like, I think if it would have been him saying, I know, and you know what? I'm sorry that didn't work out.
I didn't see it as gloating. I saw it more as eye roll. Brian knew what the outcome was going to be. He had chosen not to do anything about it and was just like, I know.
And to me, it was akin to him saying, I told you so, and like walking away.
Let's talk about regular Roy taking his dump later that night.
God.
That grunt that regular Roy makes as he's like easing that one out was great. It really made me laugh. And then he discovers that he's glued to the toilet. I thought this was really good comedy writing there. I didn't know that Cohen and Lippman did comedy.
and it's because they knew we weren't going to get criminal justice out of this. So yeah. Why not a little vengeance?
The one thing that I thought was a little weird is that in high school, Brian was trying to make synthetic cum. What is that? What's he going to do with it?
I learned just in the first season of this series to not really question a lot of Brian's decisions. He does what he wants, and who knows what he was going to do with that.
I do like that he just kind of mysteriously had this textbook from, like, what was it, middle school or whatever, like, at his ready. He's pulled it right out. You don't see anything like that in his loft, because his loft is, like, completely minimalist, but he still has this chemistry textbook somewhere. Everything wrapped up with this storyline at the Taylor house, and I really liked how Brian did a complete turnaround this episode to where he's the one that's actively participating in physical therapy with Justin. He's a part of it. He's not hiding in the hallway. He's not pretending not to see him. He's there. He's present.
He's literally on the doorsteps.
That was something that I don't think we'd ever seen before, you know, Brian being almost like a welcome guest at the Taylor home. And then, to be honest, though, this was Jennifer's house because they broke up in the last episode.
Yes, it was her nice little townhome.
Yeah. Jennifer, what have you done in this scene, though?
So I would like you to leave and never see him again.
I care about him.
It was because of you he was almost killed. Forgive me for being so blunt. I've tried to accept him for who he is. To accept your world and that he's part of it. I've even tried to accept you. And as a result, I nearly lost him. And I don't intend to lose him again. So if you care about him, and I believe you do, you'll do what I ask and return my son.
That was where I was kind of like, Jennifer, no. It's like, we love you so much. It's like, you can't, like, send him away.
But she is very calm and explains herself. And to me, she's seeing it from a mother's perspective and being very protective. And I get it. She is saying that he is still 18 years old and almost died. And I just want to make sure that he has recovered fully. I have worked very hard to accept him and hell, to even accept you.
Yeah, she had these lines that were really, really harsh on Brian. I thought it was very unusual that Brian just kind of accepted that and walked away. He looks stunned as he's getting into the Jeep and driving away, but that seemed un-Brian-like.
Well, remember in first season, he was ready to, like, bring the family back together and leave it at that.
But then he stomped out.
Well, he stomped out because he wasn't going to have any of Craig's bullshit.
And took Justin with him.
So here, I think he understands that this is not Jennifer being malicious. I think this is...
I don't know. I think he knew what to think. He just looks so, like, thousand-yard stare, and he's just kind of like, I can't believe this is happening. I thought I lost him once. Now I'm losing him again, and I can't do anything about it.
At this point, I think he has to understand that there is something more at stake than just saying, oh, I care about Justin. You know, I think there has to be an acknowledgement that this is still Jennifer's son, even though he's 18 or whatever, that allowing her to be there for her son.
Yeah, this writing was just a little strange to me, and it almost seemed like it just a little too much of a plot device, because for the last year or so, Justin has been living more or less on his own. He was living with Brian briefly, then he went to New York for two nights, then he came back and lived with Debbie for a while.
In which Jennifer started to see him there until she could get out of her own situation. And I think now that she possibly has a chance to rebuild her family, I think that's her focus. I don't think it's just because Brian, you know, at this point cares for him. She wants to be able to at least, it's sort of like you saw the building blocks crumble and she has to rebuild. And that involves her also mending the relationship with her son. Because clearly she's been cut out for a certain bit. And then it takes something like a traumatic event like this to possibly be what brings them back together. And I think...
Yeah, I can see her reaction making sense in that line of thinking. But you have to know that it's just not going to end well. That sure. You can't keep Justin away from Brian. And any attempt to do so is just going to keep going negative, negative, negative to Jennifer Taylor. So I'll give it to her in this case because she's still a little shell-shocked by the events of the past month. But I just thought that this writing ended up being a little tricky could be taken a couple of ways. The thing I did like about this scene was the fade out as Brian drives away. There's two kids playing catch with the ball, whereas Brian and Justin were working on the ball as a physical therapy thing. And the song there that was playing on the way out was called No More Good Guys. And I looked up the lyrics for that. And despite Brian's best efforts to get on the right side of all that, he loses out in the end. And that's, I think, why that song worked really well there. So hats off to the music supervisors there, even though, of course, you didn't get to hear that if you stream this episode. Mm-hmm. Can we stop saying that?
Yes. We'll be right back. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
The B story of this episode, I think, was really Lindsay and Melanie and this wedding that they went to.
Lindsay's sister's third wedding.
Did you think it was weird that apparently Mel and Lindsay received separate invites with a plus one each? So instead of like the two of them, they didn't want a scene to be made. Four people went. Isn't that a bigger scene?
And so instead of bringing just the two gay people that could possibly fade into the background because they're not nearly as out there, they bring two of the more flamboyantly gay people. So you just doubled your numbers. What were you thinking?
I did like this plot line, though. I loved that they brought beards, even though it was implausible. It reminded me of this line from, it's by Aristotle, and it goes something like, probable impossibilities are preferred over improbable possibilities. So it essentially means if you're able to suspend disbelief and just kind of buy it, that'll carry your story better than if you just can't buy it from the get-go. So I could buy this from the get-go where they needed to bring beards. I just thought it was weird that they each brought one. There was this lavish exterior scene as this wedding's getting started. There were like hundreds of people in that scene.
Right. And it's like you have to remind yourself, oh, that's right. Lindsay is privileged white girl.
Yeah. The extra budget must have been huge for this episode.
Of course, that doesn't, you know, even as their beards, that does not stop Emmett and Ted from clocking the hot usher.
Yeah. Well, and the hot women, too, as they're walking by and they're taking a look at Ted. And Emmett had this funny knock on Ted where he says,
hard to believe, but in this parallel universe, you're actually hot.
Woo-hoo, lucky me.
Fuck you, Emmett.
I thought it was great.
So funny. It's so funny.
All the women are just checking out Ted.
They're like, ooh, man with stable income.
Yeah. As Lindsay's explaining why they're there, and this was just, she was explaining it to us, not to anybody that was present in the scene. Melanie had this line.
What did she think we were going to do? Perform cunnilingus on top of the wedding cake?
But it seems like bringing Emmett and Ted would be like just as dramatic as that.
And as it turns out, it kind of is. And, you know, we know that this is from Lindsay's parents, that this is her sister's third wedding. And this is the last one they're going to pay for.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and like, wasn't that like three weddings, like in a very short period of time?
Oh, yeah. There was a really funny scene at the wedding where Melanie is outside for a smoke break with Ted and Lindsay. Apparently, all the guests are seated indoors because the outdoor seating on the veranda was completely untouched. All the tables were still set. There's a big table of presents set up. And then from out of nowhere, we see Emmett pop up out of the bushes where he was blowing the usher. And it looks like he swallowed too.
Well, yeah, because spitters are quitters.
Emmett pops up and he says,
well, I'm having a much better time than I thought.
And don't forget that he is still a proper lady, and he did wipe his mouth with his handkerchief as he popped up.
And Ted dabbed up the extras that he missed.
I thought it was such a great little detail.
Lindsay's sister thanks her for not embarrassing her at the wedding because of her private life. I like that little cloak term, a private life.
Meanwhile, Lindsay's like, hold my beer.
She starts to give the toast, which this was interesting. It's like, I don't think I've ever seen the sister give a toast.
Because I don't think she was a maid of honor. She just was just invited.
She was just there,
yeah,
with her beard.
And so Lindsay takes this moment to propose to Melody to get
Emmett
married.
Starts crying.
Emmett can see a mile away what's going on, and it you know, all the emotions are flowing.
Oh, that, I love it when Emmett gets teary-eyed. All the other guests are completely silent, though, but you would think that there'd be, like, somebody there that would also think that it was nice.
Like
but,
the usher.
Yeah. His hands were full. Later that night, Lindsay's on the phone in bed where we see some gratuitous nudity.
As she's hearing her mother scream on the other line. Because remember, Lindsay did take this moment to use her privilege and say, I am going to ruin this day for you and really piss off mommy and daddy by proposing to my girlfriend in front of everyone. Because just to show, I don't give a fuck what you think about my lifestyle.
I did like when Melanie popped up and said, oh, sure, blame it on the Jew. And then Lindsay hung up on her mother and called her a bitch. I like that. I like that funny little scene there.
I mean, she's not wrong. So
the funny part about this scene was that Melanie didn't seem to think that Lindsay was at all serious about
because
the proposal.
She saw that she probably just did it to piss off her parents, and what a great time to do it.
I don't know. When she said it in the scene, though, it looked to me like she was serious, that it wasn't just to kind of rile up the crowd. But I guess in 2002, it was probably much more hyperbole to make a marriage proposal, because you couldn't do anything with it. You couldn't get married then. So maybe that's why, or part of the reason why nobody took it seriously. But Melanie shrugged it off with words worthy of Brian, where she says, they're antiquated, meaningless rituals for heterosexuals. That's something that Brian would say. And I think he has said something pretty close to that. I don't know if he said it yet, but he'll say it eventually. Brian and Melanie in that one moment had more in common than I thought. Lindsay did a double take at the end of Melanie's speech. She seemed actually hurt by that, by the antiquated, meaningless rituals for heterosexuals. It almost seemed like she was taken aback that her partner would say something callous that way.
Very so cold.
Yeah, it's a nice thread that hung out there. There's a couple other really funny items in this episode that weren't really part of any of the plot lines, but Emmett was conveniently looking for a roommate.
Right. You know, open room, and you know, if he doesn't find one soon. So we get a glimpse at what Emmett's interview process is like.
Oh, I love that so much.
Which is,
I've got a spare room. Do you think I should try to see if I can let the room out?
As long as you Lysol the counters when you're done. Sure. And I just... But unfortunately, none of the folks measured up.
A little runner in this episode was Michael moving back to Pittsburgh. There just wasn't a whole lot of action around that story, which was unique because Dr. David and Michael were a huge part of season one, but Cohen and Lippman just tied a bow right on Dr. David, and he's gone.
he's gone, and Michael was having issues trying to get a job there, and that led to some sort of fight where Dr. David Cameron just said, then just go home, Michael, just go home.
That was very unlike Dr. David, and I'm defending Dr. David here. I think Cohen and Lippman gave him words that Dr. David would never have said.
Exactly. We saw all through season one that Dr. David Cameron would fight to keep Michael in his life. We saw it throughout the season. We watched so many other fights, and we saw them overcome obstacles, like when Dr. David Cameron went to the bathhouse and he confessed that, and Michael attempted to have his own trig and it didn't work out because he knew that it wouldn't work for him. They overcame that. So for him to be like, I'm getting homesick or whatever, it was just such a throwaway to everything that has been built up in season one, that to just give a bit of dialogue to, like, well, this is what happened and it's over.
I found it plausible that Dr. David could be pushed to that level, but you can't just sum that up in a couple lines.
No, we need to have been seeing that.
We need closure.
There's been too much investment in that storyline for Michael to then just casually toss it away. I get that, you know, it's now a more episodic series that, you know, who knows? Maybe they didn't think they were going to get renewed for a second season.
I did like how Emmett brought the usher home with him.
With and, the cake.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't understand that part. Like, they somehow managed to carry home two slices of cake on a plate. I don't know who was driving or how they got home, but then Emmett has a great idea to give Michael a slice of cake or put it under his pillow. Little surprised that we find Michael bottoming hardcore in the spare room.
He is just getting it.
Why did Michael bring this guy back to the apartment? Why wasn't he in the back room at Babylon?
That is a detail that I still do not understand, because why would he want to have put in the inherent risk of possibly getting caught with this trick when he has not told Emmett? It didn't make any sense to me.
I liked how Michael is showing the hunky top, who was like a hunk.
Oh yeah, I want to know more.
He's showing him out, and the hunky top like whacks him on the ass and turns around, and then Emmett just snaps on the light, and there's Michael naked. And I love that, because I think anybody that's ever have had roommates eventually runs into that situation.
Right. I have not. Seen that since having a roommate.
I have.
But I definitely have watched the roommates usher a trick out.
Fully clothed.
Like, session is over.
Oh, I've seen the naked version.
Oh, I have not. I have not experienced that.
So I related to this scene.
And I do love the fact that Michael's hunky guy is credited as Michael's hunky guy.
Is he really?
Yes.
You're kidding.
Yeah. He was also...
I wrote that in my notes. I had no idea.
He is credited as Michael's hunky guy. He was also in a video called Bi Models.
Oh.
It is an adult video.
Go figure.
And the plot keywords on IMDb are bisexual, sex, and hardcore. So he's a porn star.
Ooh.
We will have to look up Rick Knight later on.
Rick Knight.
Rick Knight. That's such a poor name.
I did think it was unusual that it took 35 minutes into this episode for Michael to tell his best friends that they broke up. But
right. Just waiting for the right time. But I'm like, I think the right time would have been before bringing a trick over.
Yeah. Emmett didn't seem surprised by it. Ted was like, eh. And then they got a little pissy over it. And the thing that I didn't like here, though, is that Michael totally blamed himself for the breakup, where he's saying, I blew it.
Yes, it was all his fault. And that didn't really track with me.
Which I'm okay with that storyline, but we need to see that. They just can't break up. It occupied 16 hours or so of season one, and Dr. David is just gone with a fitful little line. We deserved more.
Yes, I think I have put too much investment in the relationship between Michael and Dr. David Cameron for it to be over with a single line. No, thank you.
You and I actually fought on air over Dr. David Cameron.
Was it all for nothing?
Exactly. Ted pulled another piece of wisdom out of thin air. Wisdom from Ted, another segment where he says,
as for coming home, there's no shame in that. What it's here for.
Okay, let's recap this episode. We're going to do something new in season two, and we're going to rank each episode on three categories: timeliness, accuracy of the information that's presented, and relatability. So, Matt, for timeliness, how would you rank this episode?
I give it a ranking of 3.5. I mainly derived it from the way the sentencing worked with Chris Hobbs, and how we saw the bias of the judge. I think that's something that's still very apparent today, though I do believe we are now starting to see a turn of the tide, which is why I ranked it just a little lower on our scale, particularly with the case of Larry Nassar and the judge very eagerly saying, I am sending you away for life because your actions are that heinous.
I gave a 3 for timeliness for something pretty similar. The gay panic defense, even though it's banned in 2 states, is still out there. It's rarely used, but it's still available. And I did key in on the judicial bias that can still happen today, especially in the political climate that we have, especially at the federal level, where judges are appointed for life and they are appointed by Donald Trump right now. How about accuracy for this episode?
I gave it a 4. mainly because I really bought into the recovery process that they were showing. I thought it was detailed and showed a good progression. I liked that it wasn't just Justin was miraculously recovered the way Ted was with his with his coma. We're seeing him struggle and continue to work. And I also really like the way they handled Brian's PTSD of the situation, holding on to the scarf. But then when he finally is able to relieve himself of that by talking to Justin, we're starting to see him progress to recovery as well.
I give it a 5 for accuracy, mostly because I like the sensitivities to the PTSD. Relatability.
I gave this one also a 3.5.
Okay.
Mainly because I liked seeing the friends together again and trying to band together. And as, you know, they're overcoming their various trials and tribulations. And it was just, it was nice to see that there was hope again in this group because season one left us in a very dire situation.
I gave relatability a 5. I related to Justin and Brian's PTSD story. I related to the mother wanting to re-engage with her son, for better or worse. I had some structural problems with that. And I totally related to the beards at the wedding. So I gave that one a 5. This was episode 1 of season 2. Home is where the ass is.
Next week, we'll cover episode 2, All Better Now.
Until then, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
We'll see you next time.
See you then.
Thanks for listening. Leave a like, share with a friend, and subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.
Hey, Todd, how's it going?
Hey, fine.